Today's Teisho will be on case 4 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 4 is entitled The Western Barbarian with No Beard. Wakawan said, "Why has the Western barbarian no beard?" Mumon's comment, "Study should be real study, enlightenment should be real enlightenment. You should once meet this barbarian directly to be really intimate with him. But saying you are really intimate with him already divides you in two." Mumon's verse, "Don't discuss your dream before a fool. Barbarian with no beard obscures the clarity." So this is the last day of our winter 2017 sesshin, and I want to thank everybody for doing an excellent job this morning in the Zendo. If you have been here for 5 days, you've been working really hard with your koan or with koans. And if you arrived on Friday night, you're now in the second day of sesshin. And typically, the second day is the hardest day. When people come to sesshin on the first day, they often find that their thoughts are preoccupied, or that they are preoccupied by thoughts of, you know, the world they have left behind. So if there's a problem at work, you're thinking about the problem at work. If there's a problem in your life with, say, family or an illness, you know, it seems to get worse, right? Because you're sitting on your cushion in silence, and of course your mind immediately goes to the things that bother you. Usually around day two, people begin to get a little detachment from all of those thoughts. You know, just focusing, meditating for 8 hours a day on day one produces a change. When you start day two, your mind is much less gripped by all of those thoughts about your problems, or at least just somewhat less. A new problem presents itself. You know, your legs probably, if this is your first sesshin, your legs probably hurt. You know, you're probably feeling like, you're running out of steam. By the end of the day, you may be, you know, quite tired. If you are here on your fifth day, you know, we've been working really hard. You know, this is so different from the image of the image people have. You know, if you say to somebody, I'm going away on a spiritual retreat, right? You know, generally speaking, if you have friends and neighbors who don't know anything about Zen sesshin or meditation in general, you know, they'll think, oh, that sounds wonderful, right? You know, we'll get together in a circle, and we'll talk about spiritual things, and have a nice breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and just think great thoughts, you know. And there are places that make millions of dollars a year actually providing those experiences. It's true. As you can tell, I'm skeptical, you know, about that. I feel that, happiness is a little harder to achieve than that, you know. So generally speaking, people sign up for those courses. They're really like courses or seminars. And they bring to the seminar all the skills that they used to have in school, right? So they might even take notes, right? And this is really common. You know, people take notes. They have like a workbook. They might come back from the seminar with reading for further study. You know, it's just like a course on Renaissance literature, or you know, and they definitely feel, you know, at the end of this that they've gotten some insights. You know, I'm really skeptical about the power of that kind of an experience. Because I feel that if it were only so simple that we could read it in a book and our lives would be different. I just don't believe that ideas have that power to transform us. I do think ideas are important. Having good ideas is better than having bad ideas. But they're not, they really are only skin deep, right? And we also tend to pick the ideas that reaffirm our own commitments and assumptions about the world. So, you know, there are very few financiers on Wall Street, for example, who one day read Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto, give away their money and, you know, become a guerrilla in the mountains of some South American country. That doesn't happen because they don't read that book, right? They'll read the books that they like. They'll read the people they want to read and their peers read. So it's very hard to expect ideas to liberate us. We tend to gravitate to the ideas that we already are looking for. So there's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy about this, you know. Going to the seminar and listening to the lectures on what is happiness, you know, how do we become better people, I'm skeptical about that because I just don't think ideas have that liberating power. So when you come to Sesshin, it's such a different experience, you know. It doesn't fit with that at all. I mean, for one thing, we're really not trading. We really don't. There's a teisho, you know, once a day, and those are words, those are ideas, and hopefully, it gives you the energy to keep sitting, you know. But most of the time we spend at Sesshin is spent on the cushion, with our legs folded up in front of us. And a certain amount of physical discomfort, you know, pain is an interesting thing. I find pain to be really valuable. Now, I have pain in my legs just like anybody else, and I don't like pain, right? So I much prefer to be comfortable to being uncomfortable. So I'm not saying that pain by itself is a good thing or does anybody any good. But it's definitely the case that when we're uncomfortable, some of our barriers fall away. You know, some of our careful self-maintenance falls away. It's like we just can't afford to be worried about, say, how our hair looks when our legs are throbbing, right? And that's actually a plus, right? But also, I think when people are in pain, they often experience a kind of vulnerability or honesty that they don't always normally have, you know? So sometimes when people are in pain, I've noticed many people when they're experiencing physical discomfort, you know, actually become much softer and nicer people. You know, it's a paradox, but it's genuinely the case. I remember my brother, for example, he's no longer alive, but he was. He was a cynic, sort of like a very funny, skeptical guy. That was his identity. And he was funny, but not always in a totally nice way. You know, he wasn't a bad person, but his humor had an edge to it, right? And he read the, you know, not that people who read the Wall Street Journal are bad, but he read the Wall Street Journal every day. You know, he was a business person. He had a BMW, you know, so. And he was funny. He, you know, he would a little bit like somebody we know who's president, right? Or soon to be president. You know, he would say these outrageous things, and you would find yourself laughing, and then you realize, oh, that's terrible, you know. So, but my brother got very ill at one point, and you know, when I went to see him, he was like a different person, and he was so open-hearted. You know, it's very difficult to you know, it was just I went to see him. He had a cancer basically, and he eventually died of that, but. You know, I came back and I said to my wife, you know, that is like a different person, you know. And he was so open and so kindly, you know. So I definitely think that we have this, you know, these barriers we create, and they're very carefully maintained. And we learn to do that, you know. Growing up is how to be a person, how to maintain, say the right thing, do the right thing, have the right look. And there are penalties for failing to do that, right? So you know, you get very good at presenting a self in public to others. But when my brother had cancer, you know, he just couldn't maintain that anymore. And he was in pain a lot of the time. And I was just deeply moved by how kindly he had become. It was like a different person. So, you know, we're not doing ourselves any harm by sitting on a cushion. You know, our legs might hurt, but you're not hurting your legs structurally. I've been doing this for 40 years. My circulation in my legs is excellent. I have, you know, good coordination, you know, good blood pressure, you know, so you won't hurt your legs. You can run, you can play tennis, whatever, you know, if you do this. But you are in discomfort, and it does sort of like break open the shell, right? And just being broken open like that makes it possible to see things in ourselves that we don't ordinarily allow ourselves to see, and to be kind of exposed or vulnerable in a way that we're not able to be when we're sitting comfortably in our chair in reading the Wall Street Journal over breakfast. You know, this is a very different idea of what it means to be transformed. It's not about listening to lofty ideas that we already agree with. It's about cracking open ourselves and examining the content, you know, little by little, step by step. And that is hard work in a number of different ways. It's hard to sit on the cushion for half an hour, waiting, you know, watching one breath at a time. You know, when I first started doing meditation, you know, getting through half an hour was a major achievement. And you know, and I remember at Sesshin, you know, it was just like, I would just think, can I just get to the end of this sit without moving, you know? And it would just be like one breath, one breath, one breath. And it just felt like I was on a tightrope, and I looked and the rope just went on and on and on. I could barely see the other side of the cliff, you know? It just seemed like interminable to get to that other, you know, finally getting to the other side of the end of the rope, can step down, safety. Usually the bell, I just couldn't make it across at first, you know. So it's challenging to maintain that kind of mental focus with your knees or your legs or your back hurting, you know, and that really, it wears you down. It cracks you open. But, you know, I think people are more likely to tell the truth under those circumstances. You know, I really do. To themselves, they're more likely to see something that they haven't wanted to see. So it's crude to be in pain, right? It's like crude. It's a crude therapy, you know. But it's so important, you know, because we like to pretend we are these disembodied beings who live in a pure world of ideas or something. But, you know, basically we're human beings. We have pain. We're born. We have painful experiences. We basically get sick and we die, right? That is the life of a body, right? And we also have our joys, right? We might fall in love. We might have a family, children. You know, so those things are also happening. So the very pluses also. But definitely we have a body. A body is essential. With no body, no enlightenment, you know, basically. So sitting in pain might seem crude and unnecessary, but there's nothing like that. It doesn't have to be constant pain. It shouldn't be numbing if your head is spinning because you're in so much pain. Uncross your legs and stretch. You know, it's okay. But, you know, when you're mildly uncomfortable or when you're somewhat uncomfortable, you have to really reach down into yourself. You know, so you know, this is a very different experience from the kind of seminar-type spiritual retreat, you know, as you know. And it's based on a very different idea about the human being. You know, and if you look at, like, pictures of Zen masters and Tibetan teachers, and also Vipassana teachers, you know, they're almost always smiling, right? So, you know, you very rarely see a picture of the Dalai Lama with a frown or a scowl, right? And there's obvious reasons for that, right? You know, but you know, there's always a smile on his face and a happy. And happiness is the goal. You know, in many Buddhist traditions, when you end a ceremony, in many, say, Theravada traditions, when they end any kind of a public event, they always say, may all beings find happiness. So happiness really is the goal. So there's nothing wrong with happiness, but how do we get to happiness? And getting to happiness is a complicated matter. Because just trying to be happy generally doesn't make us happy, actually, you know. You know, it's interesting. This koan seems to make no sense at all. Wakawan said, why has the Western barbarian no beard? So you have to know a little bit about the context for this koan. But the person who brought Zen from India to China was a monk named Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma. Chinese people sometimes call him Damo. Damo. And Japanese call him Daruma. Daruma. Bodhidharma brought Zen from India to China. And if you go into any Zen temple or Chan temple in East Asia, you will see a picture or a statue of an Indian monk, and he has a beard and usually an earring in his ear, and he has a robe, sort of like an Indian style robe. Sometimes it's pulled over, a piece of it is pulled over his head, and sometimes it's not. And he always has a very fierce, you know, look on his face, or a very penetrating look. So in any Zen temple, or any Chan temple, you would see a picture of Damo, or Bodhidharma. So every monk and every nun in any temple in East Asia would see Damo and know foreigner, in other words, barbarian, Western barbarian, foreigner, as the Chinese say, foreigner with a beard. So this koan is, why does the barbarian have no beard? See? Why does the barbarian have no beard? In other words, how can we understand something about ourselves that we don't allow ourselves to see? we know Bodhidharma has a beard. Every picture, every statue shows a guy with a beard. But the koan is saying he has no beard. So if you go into the teacher and you say, it's not true, he has a beard, the teacher will ring the bell and your interview with is over, because that's not the right answer. This is the how can I see my obstacles when I don't, when my obstacles are the things I don't see? You know, how can I see my good side when the good side is the thing I don't allow myself to see? This is the problem with trying to think your way out of your problems. You know, you can't do it. You need to use the big mind, the power of the unconscious. So, you know, this koan is in an interesting place in the book, because it comes after a koan called Gute Raises a Finger. Gute Raises a Finger is really about, you could say, and if you're working on the koan, I can tell you this and it won't help you at all. It's really about like the experience of oneness, right? The experience of oneness. So Gute's one finger is all about oneness, right? And we all love oneness, right? And when people go through the Gute's one finger koan, you know, they often have an experience that is related in some way, to the experience of like oneness or wholeness. And yet, this koan follows right after that, and it sort of like says enough wholeness, you know, enough of that wholeness stuff. Now we're going to get into trouble again. See, now we're going to have to go do some hard work again. See, now we're going to have to do some hard work again. And this is actually the same thing that happens earlier in the Mumonkan. When people are working with the Mu Koan, you know, they eventually encounter the big mind, and they, you know, you can have a very deep experience of Mu. And you might be thinking, all right, you know, it's all going to be easy now. I saw, you know, and my teacher, Genki Roshi, used to say, Mu is the hardest koan. So, you know, after 3 or 4 years, I finally answered the Mu koan, and I thought, great, thank God that's over. You know, now, on to the easy ones, right? But the next koan in the book is called Hyakujo's Fox, which I won't go into, but it's one of these devilishly difficult koans that leaves you tearing your hair out, right? In other words, you know, when you have the experience of oneness or wholeness, you know, there's still something you aren't seeing. And you need to be willing to go back into the mud, you know, back into the shadows, you know, if you want to wake up. Zen is like a series of encounters with wholeness. But you can't become fully awake if you just cling to wholeness. You have to be willing to let it go and be in a place of uncertainty and even sometimes unhappiness and pain. See? And this is an elementary lesson, right? I mean, when people start doing Zen practice, they start with the breath perception koan. And if you work on the breath perception koan long enough, you will have a deep samadhi experience, which is like an oceanic experience for some people. It's like an experience of bliss. You know, when I started to have samadhi, it was like all my problems have been solved. I can now enter samadhi. And I have to tell you, I still love samadhi. So, you know, if I follow my breath, I will get into this blissful, beautiful state, you know. And I love that state. It's like eating candy all day, right? But it will rot your teeth, you know. It's not good for you to cling to wholeness. This is interesting, right? I hope so. It's not good for you to cling to wholeness, because if you cling to wholeness, you can't experience wholeness. You know, so you have to go back into the darkness, the shadows. You have to be uncomfortable. You have to be uncertain. And that's how we make our world a bigger world, see? So this is, if you just cling to samadhi, you know, you will become a lousy human being, believe it or not. You know, because the practice of sitting on the cushion and entering a blissful state is a wonderful experience, but it immediately becomes a selfish, a very self-centered and selfish proposition. You know, my samadhi, my bliss, right? So a good Zen teacher will never let the student linger too long in samadhi. Beautiful as it is, the teacher will say, hey, good work. You've passed the breath perception koan. Now you have to go into emptiness. And that's challenging, right? It's challenging to do that. And when your teacher passes, says, okay, you know, you've passed the mu koan, right? Then, you know, immediately you're back in the mess again. You're back in uncertainty, groping. Your legs hurt. You're lost in the brambles and confusion again. Right? I mean, Master Mumon, and this is a bit of an exaggeration, but Master Mumon says the road to the top is like walking. It's like walking up a mountain of swords. And he says the on each side of the path it's littered with skulls, right? It's a very inviting way to get people interested in Zen. Right. So the smiley face is better. If you say, please try Zen, it's like walking up a mountain of swords and there's skulls all over the place. Nobody will show up, right? So the smiley face is better, right? But the smiley face is the goal, right? But on the other hand, we have to be willing to do the hard work, you know. And in that respect, it's like other things too, right? I mean, Zen is not therapy, it's not psychotherapy, but you know, basically, you know, psychotherapy requires encountering a lot of our crap, right? And there's a lot of tears and a lot of pain and difficulty, especially if you're dealing with things that are, you know, repressed traumatic experiences and so on, you know, can be pretty horrible to relive those, but you come out on the other end with a bigger world. So you know, basically this koan is strategically placed in the koan book because it's following a koan where people do encounter a deeper oneness. And then right after that, the teacher sort of snatches it out of your hands and says, now, if you think that's oneness, try to deal with this, you know. And then you're suddenly dealing with this koan that makes no sense about a guy who has a beard who has no beard. So this is the koan that says, look, there's something wrong with your image of oneness. There's something wrong with your image of oneness. There's still something you've left out. It's still something you haven't seen. There's still some shadows. You have to go into those shadows in order to widen the circle of your awareness. And this is the method of Zen, right? I mean, if you think about it, this is really talk about trust, right? Talk about trust. You're sitting in a halo of light, and there's some shadows over there to the right, and Zen says, you must go into those shadows. See, now that is trust in mind, right? You know, if you are a woman of Zen or a man of Zen, when you see shadows, you say, I'm going into those shadows. I'm not afraid of those shadows. I am not going to cling to this little circle of light. Because when I go into those shadows, on the other side of it, it's going to be a bigger circle of light. So that's, I think, the ultimate trust in mind. And that's what Zen is all about. You know, you can't, you know, even, you know, people don't understand this. When I started practicing Zen, I thought it was like this. You are totally unenlightened, and then you have this amazing experience. And you're totally enlightened, and then nothing bothers you. After that, you know, it's just great, you know. So who wouldn't want that, right? Well, you know, what is called Great Awakening, or Daikensho, is an experience that, you know, many people I know have had. Genki Roshi, Webb, Yamamoto Genpo Roshi, you know, many people I know. You know, basically, I myself have had that experience. And, you know, when I had the experience, at first I thought, well, this is it. It's like passing your koan. This is it, you know. It's now the easy part, right? But it's really, you know, you realize afterward that you still are a fairly screwed up person. It's true, you know. You are still a screwed up person. And by the way, if you ever meet a teacher who says he is not a fairly screwed up person, please don't follow that person. Please. You are making a terrible mistake. If anybody says, I am a fully enlightened Buddha and I have no karmic remainder, run. Run. And the world is full of such people. They are terrible people. They leave a trail of destruction, you know. So, you know, the truth is that, you know, the Buddhist teaching is that Buddhas are very rare, you know. You get one Buddha basically per world age, right? So one of my teachers, I said, how long is a world age? And he said, imagine an angel coming down. And he, you know, he gave me this story about the angel's wing brushes a cube, which is like, you know, a million miles long. You know, it's a cube a million miles on each end. And it brushes it, and the number of times it would take to, you know, basically dissolve the cube is a... In other words, he didn't know. But it's a long time. And the classical model is one Buddha... in a per world age, you know. And the Buddha is described as Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, which means enlightened without karmic remainder. Enlightened without karmic remainder. Now, all enlightened human beings have karmic remainder. Me too, you know. So basically, even after somebody has Daikensho, you know, they still have all this stuff they have to work on. They still get upset. They still, you know, get mad sometimes, you know. You know, you have to clean up. So you know, some people spend a long time cleaning up and then they have Daikensho, and some people have Daikensho and spend a long time cleaning up. You know, so it's the same practice either way. But there's always something more to clean up. There's always something more to learn. And just when you think, you know, you really think, well, you know, I think I've got it. You know, something happens and it knocks you on your butt. And that is the most wonderful thing, right? Because then it's possible to continue to grow. It's definitely the case. You know, this is so important for people to see, because one of the reasons we don't necessarily want to open things up is because we do admire the idea of being a compassionate person and being an awake person, you know. So we try to be a compassionate person and an awake person, and that's good. But sometimes that means we're afraid to face the aspects of ourselves that aren't compassionate or aren't awake. You know, this is especially true when it comes to anger. Anger. Like, you know, anger is a big no-no in Buddhist teaching. The Dalai Lama always says, anger is the worst. You know, it's the worst. You know, just a second of anger, you know, it's just so destructive. You know, so, but actually, anger can be quite healing and quite illuminating. You know, if somebody, pushes you down, you have a right to get up and you have a right to be angry. You don't have a right to kill them, right? But you do have a right to be angry. And it's actually bad for you not to allow yourself to be angry. It's actually bad for you not to allow yourself to be sad. It shows a lack of trust. You know, there was a very famous Zen master who's his teacher got sick and he was racing to see his teacher, and by the time he had gotten to his teacher, the teacher had died. And this guy was, you know, a very famous Zen master, and his teacher had died, and he walks in and he just starts bawling, right? Inconsolably sad. And somebody says to him, you know, you're the great, you know, Yakujo, what's wrong with you, you know? And he said, listen, when I want to cry, I'll cry, you know? And I think that's a deeply awakened person, or you know, somebody who's made a lot of progress, because he's not afraid of his emotions. He's not afraid of his feelings, right? You know, it's okay to cry when your best friend dies. You know, if you didn't do that, there would be something terribly wrong with you, right? You would be really screwed up, right? So Zen is not about being perfect. It's about being awake. And it's okay to say, okay, I'm mad. And why am I mad? Because my older brother used to beat me up all the time, you know? And I've never been able to deal with that, you know? If you don't allow yourself to see your anger, you'll never work that through, you know? And as soon as you say, I think I've solved my anger issue, you know, somebody's going to run over you on the road or something, you know? So it's never over. You know, why do you want it to be over, right? It's, you know, when we recite the four great vows, we say, the universe is infinite. I'm not going to stop learning until I understand everything. In other words, I'm never going to stop learning. You know, the Buddha's way is infinite. I'm going to practice it forever and ever, right? And beings who are suffering are infinite. So I take a vow to help suffering beings forever and ever. You know, why do we want it to end, you know? Well, you probably want this talk to end. You've been sitting for a long time. Wakuan said, why has the Western barbarian no beard? Mumon's comment, study should be real study. Enlightenment should be real enlightenment. You should meet this barbarian directly to be really intimate with him. See, you have to keep looking for your next barbarian. See, there's a beard you are not yet seeing, and practice is sitting in Mushin, confronting our obstacles until we live in a bigger world. If you don't find another barbarian, you're just not looking in the right place. See. And by the way, I love that word intimate, because you know that's what enlightenment is really about. It's about being intimate with every. People think detachment, right? So wrong, right? It's not about detachment. It's about being intimate with everything. But saying you are really infinite with him already divides you in two. In other words, when your conscious mind says, I've solved it, all the bugs are out of the system, right? You're definitely missing something. Mulmon's verse, don't discuss your dream before a fool. Barbarian with no beard obscures the clarity. don't get addicted to clarity. See? Don't get addicted to clarity. It's okay to be in the brambles. It's okay to be confused. It's okay to be upset. It's okay, you know, don't be afraid of that. You know, you have to go through the shadows to get to the other side.